This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. We're talking about what helps a man transition from boy to man. Now, as I think about it, I agree. But what I'm presenting is something that I know from living and feeling it myself as a man, having watched myself go through these transitions and continuing to go through them and seeing men that I know go through it. Seeing people trying to become conscious, but watching especially the men go through it. And so few men take on the task of trying to see what it's like to be different than just somebody who's spending their lives as a pleasure-seeking animal. See, it's about pain, and it's about man's tendency to avoid pain, the modern tendency to avoid pain. Not manhood, the masculine manhood, the guy, you know, who's... but a true manhood. And the difference between boyhood and manhood, and of course there is no judgment inherent in here, even though it sounds like, yes, everybody should grow up. Of course we should. But we are conditioned to be children and stay children our entire lives. This is a program that is meant to have you, the child, be embraced, you know, in all your childlikeness. I fully understand. But boy, if my program, this program, our program can help you step up to a different level of functioning, it would make such a difference because you'd make such a contribution to the world. And that's what I'm hoping for. Hey, my friends, this is Armand DeMille. But that's what man has done. That's what we boys have been taught to do, to avoid our pain and blame somebody else. So this difference between boyhood and manhood is really serious because it relates to our entire political and social structure because the guys are running the show and not very well. In avoidance of personal pain, you can create a tremendous amount of havoc. Now, we talked about the different levels of consciousness and how we can get from one spot to the next. We're talking about physical pain and emotional pain, but mostly emotional pain. Most men spend their lives trying to avoid pain. One of the ways they avoid pain is they become controllers, right? So you have this control, you get control over things. You control the gates to your house, you control the keys to your car, you control your car, you control your business, you control, control, control. Now this is to make sure that nothing can come and hurt you. See, the fear is to pain, deal with pain. I don't want to get hurt. I don't want to get hurt. It makes so much sense. Well, why don't you want to get hurt? So what if you get hurt? The other method, logic, which is also used with control, they use their minds. Instead of feeling hurt in any form, physical or emotion, you use your mind. You use mindfulness. You even hear us applauding meditation. The numbing of the body, the leaving of the body in a certain kind of way as a way of further developing your mind and further avoiding your pain. Narcotizing yourself. Most men spend their lives trying to narcotize themselves. They want to go numb. Things feel bad, so they go for their addictions, their alcohol, cigarettes, smoke, food, sugar, whatever you go for. And they go for romance, sex, and a complete indulgence with that as well. All of this as a way of avoiding pain. What kind of pain are we talking about? Is it physical pain? No, that's only a part of it. Think about the real heroes in life. Who are the real heroes? You know, are they? It's not a wartime frightened, rageful soldier with a machine gun charging up a hill who is so afraid that he becomes counterphobic and therefore he charges. He uses his rage. Is that a hero? No, that's not a hero. But think about the guy who risks his own hurt, who runs into a burning building to help somebody, to pull them out. Somebody who will risk his life. I heard of a man the other day, there was a car that blew up, and he saw that somebody was inside, and he ran in to save this. He grabbed the person out of the car, burning himself, to pull the stranger out of the car. That's a hero. See, See, there's somebody who risks their own pain to help someone else. Now, on a physical level, there's a person who will stand the beatings in a civil rights battle, you know? And there's Gandhi. I mean, just think of Gandhi standing there being whipped in his face as he stands there and doesn't avoid it and will shed his tears. But he knows he's got a purpose. He's got something to do. Facing the pain, not running from it, my friends. And it's the story. It's not the physical pain. It's the story of adulthood. It's where you go from boy to man. It's where you go from woman, from child to woman. Most men I know feel like physical cowards. You know, if you ask most men and you kind of get them down to talking about it, they feel like physical cowards. They're afraid of battles. They're afraid of fights. They're afraid of anything that might cause pain. Oh my teeth. Don't hurt my teeth. Don't slap me in the face. I couldn't take it. A slap in the face for most men would get them crying. So they avoid it. And how do they avoid it? They built a legal profession. You know, you think about the legal, this litigious society. What is the legal profession about? Don't you hit me. Instead of I'll call my mother, I'll call my lawyer. Right? I won't get my older brother. I'm going to get my lawyer. My lawyer's going to come after you. Now, you know, I'm glad there are lawyers there because lawyers do a lot of good. Lawyers have been able to get a lot of things enacted in government that wouldn't have been enacted otherwise. But this dependency on having something other, another way of avoiding confronting things. I knew a man who had somebody who lived downstairs from where he lived, and this guy who lived downstairs didn't like the fact that he had Christmas tree lights up on his terrace. So what he would do is he would send legal letters upstairs all the time. He was a lawyer. He'd send up letters about how you're ruining our property, how you're making things, you know, you're no good, how you look this way, how you depreciate our property. I'm suing you for this. I'm suing you for the guy. The guy went downstairs and spoke to the man and said to the man, listen, stop being a pain in the butt because I see you in the elevator all day long and God knows I feel like bumping you. So stop doing it. The guy stopped immediately. Am I saying that people should use physical harm to deal with each other? But no, you see, we get so used to not interacting and we get so used to not risking pain. Now, what's the pain about? Physical pain, are we supposed to be beyond it? You know? Because, you know, a lot of people love sports training. They get some satisfaction out of it because of the pain, but they're in control of the pain because they cause the pain, you see? The physical pain and the endorphins and the endurance that goes with it, you know, and you feel strong because at the end you say, aha, I went through the pain that I caused on myself. Well, that's not the pain. That's not the pain that's so hard to face. That's a pain we like to face because it makes us feel brave. You know, that extra push-up, that extra shove, that extra lifting, that extra weight, it makes us feel like we're really being strong. That's not the pain, but the pain that somebody else causes, especially the emotional pain, is what we're mainly avoiding. And so that's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about the paradox in life is that we can run from pain, or we can run towards it. But we can never not deal with it. Like death and taxes, inner pain cannot be avoided. The young, unguided boy instinctively runs from pain and from his own manhood. Most modern men's pain is the pain of running from pain. Emotional pain. These different things that you felt as a kid that you couldn't stand feeling, so you ran away from them. And you continue to run and run and run and run. This is Armand DeMille with you with the positive mind, believe it or not. I mean, you couldn't be more positive than this because what we're looking for is the plus side of the minus side of our lives. And the minus side of our lives is this endless search for something that we can't seem to find. It's neurotic suffering. It serves no useful purpose to the man or his loved ones. It's the black hole of suffering is running from your own pain. Okay, so most men will not understand what I'm talking about. One guy I worked with was incredulous when I mentioned that the goal of life was not the wise pursuit of pleasure, because he could see no other reason for living. I understood his feelings as he was in a a lot of neurotic emotional pain. Pleasure seemed his only release from emotional as well as physical pain. Gotta get pleasure. Gotta have pleasure. He did not realize that the emotional and physical pleasure he sought from his wife would not get him satisfaction. He did not realize that the rages he would go into towards his wife were really a very young boy's frustration with his mother and his father, his childhood. His intense frustration was the cause of his pain, not his wife. His rages dulled the pain without getting himself one inch closer to the peace of manhood. So rage doesn't do you any good because it dulls the pain. Yelling at your wife doesn't make it any better. Thinking she should give you more pleasure and she should make your life better just would help you avoid it a little more. See, neurotic pain is the pain of avoidance. It sidesteps the real pain of that most of us have to face, which is separation. Get this now. It's about separation. It's about letting it go. It's about not holding on, right from childhood, right from being little boys or little girls, right? You got to let it go. You got to let it go and deal with the way it feels to let it go. For example, very often I talk to men who are afraid to be alone. They need to stay busy all the time or be in someone's company. They do not realize that their actions are a way of avoiding being with their own feelings, you see. They live their lives with an undercurrent of fear of aloneness, a fear that no activity and no person could take away, because they got to face that stuff. Many men's health problems. You know, we do so many health programs here on WBAI. And we talk about stress and how stress causes the physical ailments. But most men's health programs are an example of avoided pain. If a man does not deal with his emotional pain, he will hurt someone else or he will hurt himself. A man who transmits the pain is a dangerous man to others. That's the person who's kind of taking his own pain and shouting it out and putting it on other people. A man who holds the pain inside by denying it hurts himself. Eventually, the pain that is held inside the body breaks out in a form, a vast majority of chronic health problems for men. You see, we all kind of knew it. There's a lot of different ways that we hold this pain. Anxiety is another kind of neurotic pain. Most men live several years less than women. Why do we think that is? Most men don't realize how their pain is ravaging their bodies. Women realize it. They feel it. They go through it. They feel it. Women are not the saints of the species. But they tend to feel it more than the men do, and they're allowed to feel it more. A woman crying is okay. You know, almost. Except if you're the man on the other side of it. Then you can't stand it because it reminds you of your own pain. But a woman's feeling her tears and feeling her pain, that's okay. Men, however, they can't feel it, so the pain is ravaging their bodies. They don't stop long enough to really think about it. They just die prematurely. It turns into all kinds of pain. Anxiety often means a man is afraid of imminent separation, whether from his wife, his job, his persona, his dreams. Anxiety attacks. You know, we talk about being really nervous. Anxiety attacks are really separation attacks. Leaving something behind that you don't want to leave behind. You really feel racked. A guy's at a job and he feels racked with anxiety. He's afraid that he may have to leave it. He's afraid that he may become aware that this job is not good for him. You see? The attacks come either because a man fears a separation or he's experiencing one. He has a little idea why he's so anxious so often. He may have some idea that he is anxious about his job or his marriage or his image or his future, but he would rather not think about it. The anxious man is really fearful of separation. His fear would be reasonable if he faced his separations. In facing separations, he would be understandably nervous because that's that little period of time when you go through a separation where you become nervous. because it's like fear. What am I going to do? How am I going to stand all by myself? This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, trying to talk about pain in such a way that I think you understand it. And you know, from what I'm hearing from this audience, they love this discussion, and that's why I'm finishing it up. Talking about a man and a man's anxiety, and it often comes out as job stress. You know what burnout is? Burnout is caused by being in a no-win situation. Stress is really a code word for chronic anxiety. The word stress just sounds more manly. Oh, I feel a lot of stress. You know what I mean? Yeah, I'm afraid of separating. Right? So we use this word stress as a manly way of breaking down. Job stress is the result of a man who doesn't go to work. He sends his mask to work to perform the tasks he needs to do, usually to provide this, to fulfill his provider, protector image. You know, I'm taking care of my wife, I'm taking care of my family. It's often not a job he particularly likes, yet he's caught in his patriarchal role. He figures his stress is the price he has to pay for raising a family. But he pays the price he doesn't need to pay. He suffers from chronic anxiety because he's paid the wrong price. He's been a pained cardboard character, feeling he has no choice, but he's robbed his family. Because a stressed out daddy is no fun. You know what I mean? So now he comes home, I'm a stressed out man. And what's it all about? Afraid to take the risks, afraid to deal with his separation. Listen, my friends. A man towards the later stages of his life starts to find out how his pain has started to make him a different person. If you get to that point where you begin to realize it, you're then able to experience this kind of mystery of life. You say, I'm going to feel it. I'm going to go through it. An evolved man starts to realize that his inner satisfaction comes from finding purpose, not pleasure. Got that? What's your life about? Purpose, not pleasure. Most men feel so destitute that all they could search for is pleasure. I want to feel relaxed. I want to feel comfortable. I want my wife to be nice to me. I want this. I want that. I want to have my kids grow up. I want to watch my kids graduate. But it's an endless search for pleasure, including just a feeling of safety, but not purpose. The evolved man realizes that manhood does not consist in avoiding pain. He sees that the pleasures that he strived for no longer have meaning. Addictions lose their allure. Do you ever notice that when you get older, guys? Used to smoke a little grass and grass, used to feel great, used to get stoned, and you say, oh, this is wonderful. You get older and you smoke grass, it doesn't do much to you, it kind of puts you to sleep. Same with alcohol. Younger years, alcohol will stimulate you, both stimulate you, narcotize you, put you to sleep, wake you up. Yet later in life, it doesn't have the effect. Used to be a woman chaser all through your childhood, you know, and your adolescence, and then you kind of get older, and it doesn't have that thing, one more conquest. He realizes that there is no right woman that will make his life bearable. There are only fantasies of women. He realizes that manhood does not come from protecting a woman, or that initiation does not come from her adoration. You don't become a man because a woman adores you. So striving to get a woman to adore you doesn't do it. And as a woman, striving to have a man adore you doesn't do it. It's not going to make it. Maybe for a little while, but it's only a painkiller. He will have grieved these losses, and he starts to leave his neurotic life behind. The same man, this man who kind of makes his moves through life, will also realize that his manhood and deep inner satisfaction comes for purpose, not power. He'll see that status and money do not make him feel more like a man on the inside. He will see that the respect of other men is meaningless. You don't have to get respect. He will see that all the power he has will not allay the anxiety he feels about losing the trappings. You know, if he does choose to take on the power in a corporation, a church, a club, he'll do this to fulfill a greater purpose, not to prove his manhood. hey, you know, I want to be a part of the society, and I want to achieve whatever greatness I can in the society, because I want to have a voice. Because I want to have a voice that stretches out to you. And in order to do that, I'm willing to become as successful as I possibly can so that my voice can reach out, because I think I'm doing good work. Purpose. The man in the search itself and the man in the search for himself will start to realize that the measure of a man is not how much pain he could avoid, but how much pain he could take. How much he's willing to face. How much pain he can endure for a higher purpose. So you got a partner, and your partner and you are doing a business together. And you find out your partner wants one thing and you want another. And your business success, this big thing you've got up there, has got to now separate. Well, here we come to the idea of using pain. The existential transformation of pain, rather than transmitting it, but willing to feel it, makes not only a new man, but a new idea of manhood. Pain triggers the transformation to manhood. So I am not saying people get spike shirts, hair shirts, put yourself, flagellate yourself. That's not the pain I'm talking about. I said be willing to feel the pain that comes with every separation as you take an honorable path in life. If a man cannot get past his boyhood, he cannot bring up his son and his brother's sons to manhood. He cannot find peace. He cannot give peace to those he loves. You know, and yet the peace of manhood is paradoxical because the peace of manhood includes pain. You see? The very peace will be painful. It is not a meditative, feelingless peace. It's a conscious, pain-filled feeling of peace. And that's manhood. And the pain's okay. The paradoxical pain has meaning. It goes somewhere. Unlike neurotic pain, it somehow changes the universe instead of being swallowed uselessly into a black hole. It's the pain of purpose. And only an awake man and an awake woman truly understand it. So, you know, think about it, friends. It's interesting that the word compassion means to suffer with, compassion, to suffer with. A true man will voluntarily suffer emotional pain as he realizes that joining in the suffering around him rather than transmitting or internalizing it can be as healing to the community as it was for himself. He will go to places where there are tremendous pain. He will go to, you know, you sometimes go to a meeting, and you go to a meeting, and this meeting is filled with people in agony. And he'll go there as a conscious man, not to kind of do anything about it, but just even to be there and say, let me feel their pain, and maybe my presence itself will start to transform this. And that's the way you begin to feel. You could look around a room sometimes. If you ever go to a room where you see a lot of people who are kind of miserable and you see one person just sitting there conscious, you could see the effect they have on the entire room. One aware person can change an entire room. And if that room is making policy statements of the world, that room, that person is then affecting the world. So I believe that this is really important. A transformation to real manhood brings a man to a willingness to suffer pain for the next generation as well. It's purely voluntary. The motivation is not shame or ego or status or respect. It is a man's need to fulfill what he has learned and what he has seen as part of his ordeal. And it's an okay ordeal. Want to know what job satisfaction is like? Just say you're willing to go through whatever you have to go through to be able to do what you can for whoever you can. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Listener-supported, fabulous Pacifica radio station. Home of some of the bravest people I've ever met. Some of the most courageous, amazing human beings who have put their lives at stake and are willing to face whatever they have to face to go through whatever they have to go through, you know? in order to be there, in order to kind of make a difference. Well, that's on one level, you know, and very often you have to face the emotional pain as well as the physical pain and the endurance. So what am I saying that's so radical here? You know, therapists, watch out for your supportive therapy. I'm not so sure supporting people is the way to go. The main thing that the therapist can do is help a person face themselves, not avoid themselves. You know, I can tell you the number of men that I know, number of therapists I know who have said to somebody as soon as they lose a boyfriend and they're in pain, go find somebody else. Well, you haven't gone anywhere. It's like your puppy dies and you go get another puppy. Well, then what's all the feeling about? I understand wanting to go get another puppy. I certainly understand taking the pain away from a 5-year-old child, but from adults? Give them a chance to grow up. Don't keep infantilizing them. You know what I've seen with a lot of therapists, and I don't mean this about all therapists, but many. The idea of psychiatry giving people medication means, let's show you how to avoid this pain. Very interesting thing we learned about pain the other day. We did some research and came up with the fact that, I'm sure many of you know this, that painkillers, especially narcotics, shut off the immune system. In other words, you'll kill a pain immediately, but at the same time, you will squelch the immune system. You will squelch your capacity to fight for a vibrant life. So it turns out that the highest incidence of cancers are the people who avoid the pain completely. The highest incidence of illness is the people who avoid the pain. So doctors, many of them who are just afraid of giving people drugs because they like to torture them, and other people who don't want to give drugs because they're afraid that the person may take an overdose and they'd have to be accountable. But many of them just will say, I'm not going to give you the medication you want. I'm going to give you something mild. I'll give you something to go with. I know the Josephs in New Jersey who are practicing physicians tend to do this. They tend to say, okay, let's try to get by with as many of the lighter medications as we could possibly use. Let's use mud packs if we're going to use mud packs. Let's try to get you by without killing your immune system, because we know the effect of putting this heavy-duty stuff on you. It is only when people are dying that they finally give them morphine drips, because, you know, a morphine drip does not, it's practically a death sentence. By the time you give somebody a morphine drip, which means all the morphine they want whenever they want it, which they could release with their own hand, you know, button when they have pain, you're shutting down the immune system. Very few people survive morphine drips. And it's only a last minute that they give it to them, you know. It's only at the end, or mostly at the end, that they give it to them. So if you go to a doctor and you're fighting with your doctor because he won't take your pain away, watch out. Watch out. He may be on your side, you know. It's not always wise to just avoid pain. We get so used to it. They are scared, and they run scared. We're going to talk about that, but what we're really going to talk about first is a man who's a guest in the studio with me, Lawrence Gonzalez. Lawrence has written a book called Everyday Survival, but the subtitle really tells us the story, Why Smart People Do Not-So-Smart Things. Interesting. We're going to take a short break, play you a little music, and when we come back, we'll continue with our discussion.
When you're down and empty-handed, and it's hurting to be sane, search your haste horizons for your horizontal plane. Where the skyline meets the ocean, you hold that passing frame. A breath of sweet elation, you blow away the pain. Somewhere in the distance, you catch a wave of hope. If you put up no resistance, then you will surely float. Above the domes and oceans, possess inside this fire that burns to
guide us through storm and raging tide.
Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind. Guest in the studio with me, Lawrence Gonzalez. Lawrence has written a book called Everyday Survival, What Happened to People? How come sometimes people aren't prepared? And I think there's an interesting beginning to this. Lawrence, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you.
I thought the rattlesnake story was a good story at the beginning. Why don't you tell us about you and your ceramic rattlesnake?
Well, when I was a little child, my grandmother had gone to Mexico and gotten an ashtray that was made of ceramic, and it looked like a rattlesnake. It was very realistic. It was dusty, this old Mexican stone-looking effect. And I always thought that was a very cool thing to have. And I grew up around it, and I had lots of nice associations with it because it was in my grandmother's house. Many years later, as an adult, I was hiking in the Santa Monica Mountains above Los Angeles, and I came across the ruin of a stone house that was all tumbled down except for the chimney. And I thought, oh, this is very cool. I'll search around in there and I'll find some sort of souvenir to take home, like maybe an old tool or something. And so I was poking around in the stone rubble, and all of a sudden there was my grandmother's ashtray, complete and unbroken, and I reached out to take it. And I saw its tongue come out. And I realized, of course, that the stupid mistake that I had made trying to reach for a real rattlesnake when I had, the most interesting part of the story is that I had the intellectual knowledge available to me that would have stopped me from doing that. I knew, for example, that the chances of my ever finding my grandmother's ashtray anywhere was approximately zero. I knew that I was in the high desert mountain area where rattlesnakes are common. I knew that they like to poke around in the stone ruins where the mice live. So all this intellectual knowledge did me no good in the face of this mental model of the ashtray that I had kept in my mind all these years unconsciously and invested with such nice emotional feelings.
I guess that's why many people fall in love with the wrong person. It's got to be related to it in some way. You know, you grow up, you have kindly people all around you, and you love all these kindly people, and you stop being cautious after a while. Then you go out of there, and let's say you visit Manhattan, and somebody comes along kindly, it's a rattlesnake. You know, it's a, oh, you got to be a little careful every now and then. But people lose their cautions, and this is what your thing is about.
Yes, I think that one of the things I try to do in the book is I try to show how natural systems in our brains that we have inherited over millions of years of evolution work the way they're supposed to work Only the way they're supposed to work can sometimes lead us into trouble, just as I was saying about the rattlesnake. In fact, we do make these mental models. They're simplified versions of the world. If we didn't have them, you'd have to stop and investigate everything all over every
time.
Give
me an example of a couple of mental models.
Here's a very easy example for you. The sign for handicap parking has a symbol on it, and if you ask anybody what that symbol is, they'll tell you it's a person in a wheelchair. But if you look at it carefully, it looks nothing like a person in a wheelchair. It's just some lines put together. It's very abstract. But because of the way the brain makes mental models, it's easily identifiable. So we require very little information to successfully identify things in the world. This is a good thing. It's an efficient thing. But it can trick us, as I just showed with my rattlesnake story. We immediately latch on to the most familiar thing that we've stored as that mental model. So we have to be careful about that when we're operating in a modern environment. There's another type of system in the brain that's related to this for efficiency, and I refer to it as behavioral scripts. Psychologists will sometimes call it procedural learning, like tying your shoe. You don't have to think about tying your shoe. But if you try to teach a child to do it, it's very hard to do. It's a complex thing. You have to learn, and you have to turn it into a behavioral script. So it's a system that takes something that requires all of your attention and turns it into something that requires none of your attention, which is kind of a miraculous thing, and a good thing generally. But we also have, for example, a behavioral script for driving a car. So you can drive a car without thinking. Well, that's not necessarily a good thing. That's a dangerous thing. So we have to be aware of these systems in order to let them, in order to prevent them from controlling us in bad ways.
We're all aware of people when you're driving, those people who drive. I mean, I know I'm always alert to what's happening around me. I'm aware, alert to the other driver. I'm looking at the driver in front of me and seeing if he's a good driver. I'm thinking about that. I'm actually thinking those terms. But then I also get, and I could be driving somewhere and I could be in back of a car where the person has no consciousness of anyone else, and they're on their little vacation in their SUV, and they're really asleep. And I mean by asleep, meaning that they just are in their world traveling along. They have no idea of what's going on around them.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of the dangers that you talk about. Let's talk about it on a much bigger scale. Let's talk about what happened to the airliner.
There's a chapter in the book about an airline crash, and it happened right after 9/11. Many people will remember that because there was a very striking image of a crane pulling the tail of the airplane out of the water. The plane took off from Kennedy for the Dominican Republic, and it crashed into a neighborhood on Long Island, and everyone was killed. It turns out that the way this happened was the co-pilot had developed a fear of a certain kind of turbulence. We don't know how he developed that fear, but he had developed an automated response to it, one of these behavioral scripts that I talk about. When he hit this kind of turbulence, he moved the rudders back and forth very forcefully to right the plane. If the wings tipped, he would try to untip them by pushing the rudder. This is a very bad thing to do in a large plane that's going fast.
But if you're in a large plane going fast, taking off from Kennedy, you're automatically in the downdraft of another airplane. Aren't you familiar with that? Is that what you call turbulence?
Yeah, it's the turbulence created by another aircraft. It's called wake turbulence, and you don't always encounter it. In fact, you're supposed to try to avoid it, but in this case, they did encounter it, and it scared this guy so bad that he hit the rudder pedals hard enough to tear.
Overcompensated for it.
Yeah, he tore the piece of the rudder off that moves, basically. And without that steering mechanism, the plane went into the ground and crashed, and everyone was killed. But this kind of automated behavior is what did him in. He didn't stop and think about what he was going to do in the face of this. In fact, if he had done nothing, it would have been fine. But he had worked out this automated behavior. Over a period of time, there were several incidents on the record where he had done this before with other pilots, and fortunately nothing bad had happened. And that's another thing that shapes these behaviors in us. If we do something and get away with it, it's like a reward. So you can do the wrong thing, and if you get away with it, that tells this system in your brain, that's a good thing, do it again, do it next time. This isn't a conscious thing. It just builds up pressure for you to behave that way. So I always say that when you say someone was experienced, you know, when there's an accident, they'll say, well, he was a really experienced mountaineer. The word experienced may just mean that he's done the wrong thing more times than you have, mm-hmm. and it finally caught up with him.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're speaking with Lawrence Gonzalez about our cautious self, about our sometimes absent cautious self. Lawrence is recommending that you be more alert because many of you are not alert, and then suddenly you get wakened. You know, it's an interesting thing, the metaphor of the airplane, for a few reasons, not only as a metaphor, but a reality. I think what you're saying is the following. Once you wake up, you may become awake, but how do you get to wake up? And the other interesting thing about your story is all of those people were probably going on vacation. Vacation is the state of mind that you talk about.
Yes.
That you need to be a little aware of.
Right.
What does it mean to be on vacation?
Well, in the prologue to the book, I talk about an experience I had in the Outer Banks of North Carolina while I was finishing the book. I went to a small state park called Jockey's Ridge State Park, which has some of the tallest sand dunes in the United States, some of them 100 feet tall. But it's also a place with a lot of little hills and trees and such and pathways. And I found at one point that I actually walked out there and got lost, even though the park is only a quarter mile wide and there's a big road there that you can hear. And so I stopped a park ranger, and asked him, you know, do people really get in trouble here? And he just laughed and he said, yeah, they come here in a vacation state of mind and think all the old rules don't apply, like gravity. And talked about how people fall down the dunes because they forget that gravity still works when you're on vacation. It's like vacation calories don't count. And I like this idea of the vacation state of mind because I think it describes our culture in a big way. And I explain it in many different ways. One of the ways is, you know, if you wanted to train a dog, you might train this dog by getting a handful of treats. And when the dog did something you like, you give him a treat. When he does something you don't like, you say, bad dog. And pretty soon the dog's going to be reasonably trained. We live in a culture that rewards us every day, all day long, no matter what we do. You get up in the morning, you've fed, you've got coffee, there's entertainment all day long. You know, no matter what stupid things you do, there's a bunch of rewards for you. So what does this tell us? This tells the animal inside of our brain that our strategy is good. It tells you keep doing what you've been doing. That's what the reward means.
Of course.
And so if we don't have some system of deconstructing these brain systems that I'm talking about and thinking things through a little differently, we behave blindly.
That's why we produce these guys with the placards who say, the world is coming to an end. God will make you pay for your sins. In a funny way, you know, even though that could be his whacked out crazy stuff going on.
Right.
It's almost an alert to wake up.
Well, we have a brain system that pairs things, almost anything. If a bad event happens, you can learn that a certain smell makes you feel bad because you just happen to be smelling it at that moment. And the same for good things. You know, you can learn to be attracted to things randomly by being rewarded at the same time. It's a sort of Pavlovian effect. So we have to be aware of this because it can either make us miserable, as in the case of post-traumatic stress disorder, or it can make us feel good when things are bad. There was a train crash in L.A. Where the guy was text messaging while he was supposed to be driving the train, and he blew a red light and killed a bunch of people. Well, he had obviously done this before, and it was a cool thing to do. It was something that made him feel good. So he paired a good feeling with a bad behavior, and the result was, inevitably, he was going to make a mistake.
I was in an automobile accident with a cab driver who was on the phone. And since then, you know, I've learned that, you know, being on the phone while you're driving a cab is illegal. You can't do it. But everybody does it. All the drivers do it because they're bored, because they're driving, because they want to talk to their honeys, or they want to talk to their friends, usually a language I don't understand. But I've just insisted, you must put the phone down.
Right.
Because I got punchy, but something happened to me, I became alert. And I'm usually a kindly man who doesn't ask people to change their way of being. So you talk about a need for people to become three things. What are they? What are we looking for? We're looking for attention. We're looking for alertness. What are we looking for?
Yeah, I think that we're looking for, look, we've come all this way in our evolutionary history. Millions of years in the making, we have finally gotten to a culture where the fruit is always hanging low. You know, we conquered the main troubles of our ancient ancestors, which are how to get resources like food and water, how to protect against predators, and how to be safe from our neighbors so that we can reproduce and live happily. We really have accomplished that. It's an amazing thing. But that has lulled us into a sense of complacency because the world doesn't just dump all of its hazards when that happens. So we gave up paying attention. If one of our ancestors a million years ago lived a life of frantic anxiety because she might get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger at any moment, you know, that's not exactly the state we want to live in. We don't want to live in a paranoid state of fear. But we don't also want to just go through life talking on that cell phone and listening to that iPod and watching that television show and not thinking through the things that are around us. That's why people do things like get electrocuted by hair dryers, because they believe that everything in their environment is benign and they don't ever think it through. So attention and a new way of looking at your world is part of what I'm suggesting that people learn how to employ. And one of the things I do in everyday survival is to give people an acquaintance with basic natural laws so that they begin to look at their world a little differently and understand a key point of the book, which is that everything comes with a cost. Everything you do has some cost somewhere. It may not be a cost to you in the case of American society. It may cost somebody, you know, in a third world country who's making your iPod for you something. But everything comes with a cost, and everything comes with some sort of unintended consequence that you hadn't anticipated before. And so once you start to view your world in this way, the way that I try to portray in everyday survival.
Well, give me an example. Everything comes at a cost. How does this radio show come at a cost?
Well, the radio show is a good example because it's this very organized thing, but it produces a lot of chaos. As you run this radio show, someone somewhere is burning coal to make electricity, and that coal is putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and mercury into the atmosphere, which is a neurotoxin. So you are paying... everyone is paying for our ability to talk on the radio right now. And
I'm shutting off the radio. If somebody's paying.
But, you know, all of our culture is based on someone else paying, not us, someone else.
We're beginning to learn that.
There's a chapter in Everyday Survival called the 10,000-watt light bulb. And the reason it's called that is because human metabolism takes about 100 watts of power. That's what a human uses. But in the United States, we use about 10,000 watts each. And that means it's the equivalent of burning a 10,000-watt light bulb 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And that doesn't come out of nowhere, that power that we use. It comes from someone else. It means there are other people who could be using that power who are not using it because we're using it. So we're taking the resources of many people. Each calorie that we eat in America costs 15 calories to get it to us and into us. So it's like we're eating for 15 people. So these are real things in the world today. And as we become more of a global village, and as we become more aware of global warming and what its effects are, these effects will come back to haunt us. They aren't just going to happen somewhere else. Now, this is a serious lack of critical thinking. This is, in fact, an economy that depends on us being stupid, too stupid to recognize that when you've got pure water coming out of your tap that anybody in a million countries in the world would like, that drinking bottled water is maybe not such a smart thing to
do. Or even filter the water if you're worried about it.
Or filter the water, right. So, but my point about critical thinking is that it poisons you in every way, because if you are not thinking critically enough to think about the computer or the bottled water, then you are not going to be thinking critically enough to reject the pernicious nonsense that our leaders have been forcing on us for years now, and say, hey, you know what? That guy's wrong. I'm saying that this is a system in which if I wish I could buy a component to replace in my computer instead of a whole new computer, but that in the course of developing this economy, it was in the best interest of certain people to make a whole lot of money by reselling you all the components at once every time.
You know what we need?
You
remember the old Mission Impossible when you would listen to, he would say, on your task, if you choose to accept it, and then he said, this will self-destruct in 10 seconds. We need self-destructing machines. But then again, if they do, they would send gases into the air. Okay, so there are two kinds of people. There are the people who worry a lot, And there are the people who, well, there's many kinds of people, but the two that I'm thinking about is some people don't worry at all and they get by fine. Other people worry too much and they don't get by fine. And you're saying somewhere in the middle here are three ingredients you're looking for. You're looking for people to have, number one, you want them to pay attention, right? And that means be alert, pay attention, and curiosity. How does curiosity play into this?
Curiosity is essential in this, and it's one of the things that, again, I think our culture discourages, and that is to question everything. When things happen in front of you over and over again, you tend to, as I said earlier, make these models of them that tell you basically, I already know what this is about. I don't have to think about it. I can keep going. There was a wonderful experiment done by the Washington Post. Joshua Bell is arguably one of the greatest violinists in the world right now. And somebody there convinced Joshua Bell to go play in the subway station during rush hour. And so Joshua Bell took his $3.5 million Stradivarius and went into the subway at rush hour in Washington, D.C., and put the case on the ground like they do and picked up the violin. And he played these six soaring musical pieces, these great, great performances. And 1,100 people walked by him during this 45-minute performance. Only seven of them even stopped to look. A few of them threw change in the case. He made Joshua Bell made $32 that day for that performance. But it shows you how these people have become so – they've worked out their mental models and behavioral scripts to the point that they could miss this chance of a lifetime without even noticing. And so, you know, they go into the subway and there's a guy playing violin. They don't think, wow, there's a guy who's playing really good. Maybe I should listen. Maybe I should find out more about this situation. They go to the mental model and the behavioral script, and it says, you already know what this is. It's a subway musician. Keep going. You're on your way to work. So it all happens unconsciously. Becoming more curious about your world in every way means becoming like my 5-year-old son. It's very hard to get him out of the house and off to school because he'll stop every few minutes and go, look, an ant, you know, or look, a garbage truck. You know, everything is interesting to him. It's all brand new. It's fascinating. That's a good state of mind to have. It slows you down. It costs your efficiency. But one of the things I say in everyday survival is that efficiency is not really always the best goal.
This is Armand DeMille with you. We're speaking with Lawrence Gonzalez. If curiosity is in itself the essence of survival, you know, if people, when they made love, were curious every time they ever made love, it would be a different story. You know, some of the things that happen in marriages, people get bored with each other because they lose their curiosity. They begin to get, you know, a little too complacent, and they lose interest. And we've learned that enough about the biochemistry of the brain that if you don't have new interest, if you don't have that, your brain's actually not functioning on a high level, and you could, you wind up going to sleep in a way.
Well, I'll tell you a perfect example. If you take a lion and put him in a cage and give him a steak every few hours, he's going to be a pretty bored lion, not very interested in his surroundings. If you take that same lion and put him in the jungle where he came from, he's going to be interested all the time because there's all kinds of things happening around him that could hurt or help him. And so the trouble, I mean, we've created our own trouble by solving our own problems, in effect. The culture that solves the very problems that you face in ancient times is the culture that dulls those senses that can help us. And so we're in a constant struggle to do that. But mindful awareness and curiosity are the tools that can help us in that quest.
How would people develop? I mean, the people who aren't curious aren't curious. You can't make somebody curious.
Well, I know what you're saying, and yet I have a lot of faith in human nature. And I think you can take some pretty – I have seen cases where you can take some people who are pretty, you know, unaware and not very curious and not paying much attention. And by chance, they got themselves into a horrible situation that suddenly they go home and they reexamine their lives and they think, wow, there's a lot more to this than I thought.
It's a wake-up call.
It's a wake-up call. And, you know, I know people who've had car accidents that are cancer. You know, something shakes up your life. And you start looking at things differently.
My guest is Lawrence Gonzalez. The name of the book is Everyday Survival. We're going to have to be going right now, my friends. If you wanted to hear today's program again, you could go to WBAI.org, or you can go to thepositivemind.com, where you will hear a lot of archives. And you could send an email also to Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at thepositivemind.com. I'd love to hear from you and hear your reactions. Be back with you soon, my friends.